So, first of all, just a disclaimer, this starts off a little bit intense. That's just because Kobe starts off this chapter in a very intense type of way. So I apologize in advance. But basically, he divides up this chapter. The first half is basically about beginning with the end in mind in the course of like life as a whole. And then he talks about like specific projects that a person might want to work on in beginning, you know, with the end in mind. And we'll define what it means to begin with the end in mind in a minute, but I guess it's fairly self-evident. So here's the intense beginning to this chapter. He begins by giving an exercise to help a person try and determine who they really want to be. So this is here in the beginning of the source sheets in Seven Habits, page 103. He says, "In your mind's eye, see yourself going to the funeral of a loved one. Picture yourself driving to the funeral parlor, parking the car and getting out. You see the faces of friends and family you pass along the way. You feel the shared sorrow of losing, the joy of having known, that radiates from the hearts of the people there. As you walk down to the front of the room and look inside the casket, you suddenly come face to face with yourself. This is your funeral. Now think deeply. What would you like each of the speakers to say about you and your life? What character would you like them to have seen in you? What contributions, what achievements would you want them to remember? Look carefully at the people around you. What difference would you like to have made in their lives?" So it's intense, but it's powerful. And it's basically what Shlomo HaMelech writes in Koheles, here in Source 1. He says, "Tov aleches el beis evel, it's better to go to a house of mourning, mileches el beis mishted, and to go to a house of feasting. Ba'asher hu sof kol ha'odam, because that's the end of mankind. That's what happens. V'hachai yitein elibo. And while we're still alive, while we're living, we should pay attention to this. And the Torah Tmima here writes in Source 2, "Rotzel omar shetamid mechashvin yom misalson," that a person who constantly thinks about their own end, mimeila einam chotim, they're not going to sin, because they have a certain perspective. And Kovi has a very powerful line here. I think he was quoting this from someone, but I forgot who. Here where he writes, "When you begin with the end in mind, you gain a different perspective." And this is just the punchline here, I think is powerful. "One man asked another on the death of a mutual friend, 'How much did he leave?' His friend responded, 'He left it all.'" Mm-hmm. The questioner was asking, how much money did he accumulate? How many possessions did he accumulate? And he was basically saying, well, if you want to know how much did he leave, he left everything. That when a person passes away, they don't take anything with them. So it just gives a certain perspective that, you know, that what's important and what's not important, what's important is something that really stays with us. And the next pasuk that I put on the source sheet reminds me of a little bit of a story that happened to me this past year. I was working, doing a social work internship, and you know, I was there for the whole year. It was part time, but I was there for the whole year part time. And we got like a name tag that, you know, you put like an ID into whatever it is. So I just like using underlining cards. It's just something that I like using. So at the end of the year, I wanted to keep the ID. But it said on the back, you know, this is the property of, you know, the institution where I was working, you know, return it upon departure, whatever it was. So I went over to the person who was in charge, and I'm like, can I keep this? And they said, no, you need to return it. And I don't blame them for that, because I think it's for security reasons. Like, they were very tight on security. When you came in, you had to show your ID. Like, they didn't let you in unless you showed your ID. Like, it was very, you know, they took the security very seriously, to the point where they actually checked under, it was a school, they checked under the school buses. The security guards checked under the school buses before the kids got on to make sure that no one attached anything dangerous to the bottom of the bus. Wow. So, like, they took security very seriously. Yeah, they were Israeli security guards. So I don't blame them for taking it away, but the message that it left me was, here I like worked for them for like a year, and I don't blame them at all, and they may end up listening to this, but I think very highly of them. But no, I really do. I really think very highly of them. But it just sent the message that like I could work for them for a year, and then like I want to take the ID with me, and no, I have to give back everything. And it sort of sent me a message that like there will come a time when I'll be like, listen, I put in so much effort to accumulate what I have, and now I have to leave it all behind. That's on a small scale, it sort of sent me that message. So the pasuk says here in Tehillim in Source 3, "Kilovim moso yikach hakol, lo yered acharav kivodo," that when a person passes away, they cannot take everything with them, and their honor doesn't descend with them into the grave, that they don't take anything with them. You know, they only from a Jewish perspective. They take what they've achieved in doing mitzvot and helping other people, you know, and that's it. And the Kli Yakar points in source 4 here points out that this is a message that Moshe Rabbeinu actually wanted to deliver to the Jewish people when they left Mitzrayim, when they left Egypt. So he writes, V'chazal darshu al Moshe pasuk chacham rei vikach mitzvot. So Chazal applied the following pasuk to Moshe Rabbeinu, the pasuk which says that one who is wise of heart will go after, will take mitzvos. Shekol Yisrael, hi John.
Sorry, I'm late.
No problem. We just started a few minutes ago.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the source sheet that doesn't have the mustard that my kids spilled on the other one.
Okay.
So the Chazal darshu al Moshe pasuk chacham levikach mitzvos. So Chazal applied this pasuk to Moshe Rabbeinu. Shekol Yisrael nisasku bebiza. All the Jewish people were busy taking spoils from the Egyptians right before they left Egypt. So the Egyptians were stuck in four. So the Egyptians were stuck in darkness, and you know they had enslaved the Jewish people for quite a while. So the Jewish people were entitled to take something, you know, in return. So they were busy taking things. V'hu nisasik b'mitzvos, and Moshe was involved in doing mitzvos. Ratzu l'taretz yitr lashon imo. So the reason why Chazal say that is they wanted to explain the word imo in the pasuk. The pasuk says that Moshe took the bones of Yosef imo with him. So shabar emayit esek bizas mitzrayim. It's coming to say that Moshe took only the bones of Yosef with him and not all the spoils that everyone else was taking from Mitzrayim. Ki hamamon kinyan she'eno davek imo. How do we see that from the word imo, that he wasn't taking the money? Because money and spoils is something which doesn't really attach to a person. Ki lo yered acharav kevodo, because a person's honor and what they've accumulated in this world doesn't accompany them after they leave this world. Aval masha adam mesagel masim tovim b'olam hazeh, but all the good deeds that a person does in this world, hu hadavar hadavek imo b'olam hazeh v'olam haba. That's something that stays with a person, that's attached to the person in this world and the next world. That's why the pasuk says that Moshe took the bones of Yosef with him. Meaning specifically with him, something which could attach to him. Meaning a mitzvah, something that could attach to him. And then the Kli Yakar points out that Moshe Rabbeinu intentionally wanted to perform this mitzvah specifically at this time. Now it's true, Yosef had requested, right, before Yosef passed away, he requested, you know, when you leave Egypt, you know, please bring my bones, you know, out and bury me in Israel. But, so that's I guess, the literal explanation for why Moshe was involved in doing this right before they left. But the Kli Yakar adds another reason. It could be the reason why he engaged in this mitzvah right now, specifically, in order to remind the Jewish people of the day of death, that, you know, ultimately a person leaves this world. Because when they remember that, they're not going to be running after the spoils. Because they'll realize that everything they accumulate is just going to be ultimately left for someone else. They're not going to take it with them. So Moshe Rabbeinu specifically wanted to be involved now in taking the bones of Yosef to deliver that message to the Jewish people. That, you know, pay attention to the fact that a person doesn't live forever, and that we should realize he was telling the Jewish people that they should realize what's important, you know, and what's less important. So that's how Kovi begins this. I know it's a little bit of an intense beginning, but he's trying to explain that beginning with the end in mind, in a broad sense, means thinking about what a person's goals are in life as a whole. What do they want to get out of life as a whole? And, you know, that'll help a person make decisions on the day-to-day. As the Torah Tzmima said, that then a person doesn't sin. As the Kli Yakar says, that a person's not necessarily running after, you know, materialism, because they recognize what their long-term goals are in the course of life. Fine, so after that intense introduction, Kovi goes on to defining what it means by beginning with the end in mind. So he says here at the bottom of the first sheet, on page 104, the most fundamental application of begin with the end in mind is to begin today with the image, picture, or paradigm of the end of your life as your frame of reference or the criterion by which everything else is examined. So what the long-term goal is, what you imagine, you know, I guess, accomplishing throughout the course of your life, and through that to decide what to do on a day-to-day basis. Each part of your life, today's behavior, tomorrow's behavior, next week's behavior, next month's behavior, can be examined in the context of the whole, of what really matters most to you. So I'm going to decide to do, today, tomorrow, this week, whatever is most important to me in the long run. By keeping that end clearly in mind, you can make certain that whatever you do on any particular day does not violate the criteria you have defined as supremely important, and that each day of your life contributes in a meaningful way to the vision you have of your life as a whole. To begin with the end in mind means to start with a clear understanding of your destination. It means to know where you're going so that you better understand where you are now, and so the steps you take are always in the right direction. And this is very reminiscent of perhaps one of the most classical Musar Sfarim, Sfarim of personal growth, is the Mesilas Yesharim. It's arguably the most popular one. And he begins his introduction with the following here in Source 5. Yesod HaChasidus, the foundation of piety, V'shoresh HaAvoda HaTmima, and the root of the perfect service of God, Husha Yisbarer V'yisames Eitzel HaAdam, is that it should become clear and true to a person, Macho Vaso Ba'olamo, what's his obligation in his world? A lot of people point out that it doesn't say what's his obligation in the world. It says what's his obligation in his world, to point to the fact that everyone has their own goals and their own life mission, and a person has to realize what their own personal mission is. And to what a person should direct his vision and his purpose in everything that he does every day of his life. So it sounds almost exactly what Kovi was saying, that the foundation of true service of God is that a person should be clear on what his lifelong mission is, what's his chovaso b'olamo, his obligation in his world, what's his personal lifelong mission, and based on that he'll set his vision and his purpose for everything that he does for his entire life, on a daily basis. This whole chapter was very reminiscent of the Sefer Mesilas Yesharim that we just saw in a lot of ways. Another similarity is that the way the Mesilas Yesharim works is he describes a particular characteristic, and then he says, after describing the characteristic, the next chapter is always like ways that you can attain that characteristic, and then the next chapter is like things that could prevent you from attaining that characteristic and how you can overcome them. So after Kovi begins by telling us what the trait, the characteristic is of beginning with the end in mind, so then he talks about what can get us distracted from, what can prevent us from keeping the end in mind. So he writes here, page 105, it's incredibly easy, by the way, last time I got different feedback about whether people wanted it to be more interactive, less interactive. If anyone wants to, feel free to chime in. So it's like a chavrusa. It's a group chavrusa here. So if anyone has comments, questions, excellent points, please share. Fine. So he says here on page 105, it's incredibly easy to get caught up in an activity trap, in the busyness of life, to work harder and harder at climbing the ladder of success, only to discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. Parenthetically, that reminds me of something else that I read in a different book, I think I mentioned the first time, another amazing book by Richard Carlson. It's called The Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and it's all small stuff. So he says, be careful what you hope for, because you might get it. And he brings an example there of a person who's always working and working so hard, such long hours to get ahead, because he wants, to be the top in the company, to get the top job in the company. Then he gets the job, and everyone's giving him a headache. They want him to do this, they want him to do that. No one's happy with his work. He has to work till who knows what time at night. So be careful what you want, what you ask for, because you might get it. So he's saying here that it's possible that a person can be so involved in the busyness of life that they're working harder at climbing the ladder of success only to discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. They were very successful, but not in the way that they would want to be. It is possible to be busy, very busy, without being very effective. People often find themselves achieving victories that are empty, successes that have come at the expense of things they suddenly realize were far more valuable to them. In other words, like the example there of Richard Carlson, he's achieved success, professionally, but it's at the expense of perhaps his time, relationships with other people, etc., whatever it is, things that they recognize were really more valuable. People from every walk of life often struggle to achieve a higher income, more recognition of a certain degree of professional competence, only to find that their drive to achieve their goal blinded them to the things that really mattered most, and now are gone. So if a person's going to put in so much effort, they want to make sure that the ladder is leaning against the right wall. That they're not, the way I always heard it is barking up the wrong tree. That was always the the metaphor that I heard. But,
Let me just ask you something, just pretty briefly. When one talks about, when one finds in Sfarim this whole question of, people defining their Tachlis HaChaim and so forth, it may be a question that's beyond the scope of this here, but I guess the question is, it's fine and well to have that as an objective, but where does one find in Sfarim, Musa Sfarim, whatever else, the direction for, from a Torah perspective about how to do that. In other words, it's clear that there's you know, the Muslim Sfarim feel that that's an imperative that one should, but do you know whether there are Muslim Sfarim that actually provide that sort of hadracha in terms of how to do so?
So I have two things to say, which are not going to be so helpful. The okay. first is that it's not beyond the scope of this year, but it's beyond the scope of my knowledge.
Okay.
It's a hard question to ask.
That's
meaning,
an honest,
like,
that's an honest
how
answer.
How is a person supposed to know what their direction in life should be and their personal, you know, mission, visions, and goals? That's a personal question. It's very hard for a person to really, you know, determine that without thinking about, you know, what they really value. There is a Gemara in Brachos which is relevant to this, I guess, and that's that the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave everyone the desire for their particular profession. And the Gemara brings an example to say that you could have certain professions which you know, you might think that someone really wouldn't want, but those who have that profession, they really are driven by it. That's really something that they enjoy doing. So the way the Gemara presents it is it's almost like a blessing that God gives us, that that we enjoy, you know, that we can each find, you know, a certain thing to a certain, you know, venue to contribute to the world. And that God gives us enjoyment from that venue that we choose. But I think there are those who understand it, that it can also be used as guidelines for trying to figure out, you know, what is one's mission? You know, where does one get, I guess the expression that they would use in Hebrew is Sipuk HaNefesh, where does one derive satisfaction? If I derive satisfaction from a particular thing, so it's very possible that that's my mission. Now, I don't think that has to be that way, meaning if a person derives satisfaction from doing something which they shouldn't be doing, it's not a sign that that's their mission in life.
Right.
But that could be a clue. It could be a clue.
Okay.
But I struggle with that myself. How am I supposed to know what my mission is in life? I think it's a deep question a person has to ask themselves. I was just wondering
whether, I wasn't asking sort of specifically regarding myself, but I was just wondering whether Musa Svarim actually give that.
Right. So I've heard it discussed in the context of that Gemara and Brachos, that if you feel like a certain drive to do to serve in a particular venue, so
sure.
It makes sense that could be your mission.
Okay.
But,
All right. Okay, don't
worry. Yeah, sorry if I wasn't addressing the question the way you meant to ask it.
Fine.
So the Mesilas Yesharim expresses the same point, you know, not to get caught up in distractions that prevent us from thinking about, you know, what the right wall is that we want to lean our ladder against. And he writes here in Source 6, so this is one of the tricks of the evil incarnation and his cleverness, his schemes, to weigh down on a person's heart with constant work, until a person doesn't have any time, any break, to think about and to look in which direction they're going. A person doesn't have time to think about what direction I'm going in because I'm too busy working. Because the evil inclination knows, I'm not sure exactly how to translate every Hebrew word there, but the basic idea is that if a person would pay attention to their ways, so they would immediately recognize if some of their ways, you know, were not correct, you know, that if they were doing something improper, then they would recognize that if they had time to think about it. They would regret what they were doing if it was something that they don't want to be doing, until they would leave sin entirely. This is like the scheme of Paro. Right, the Jewish people kept saying, you know, we want to go. So Paro said, give them more work. They won't have time to think about the fact that they want to go. So he didn't want to give them any time to pay attention or to maybe plan some type of rebellion against him. He was putting an effort to distract them from any thought and paying any attention. Through the constant work. Kain hi atzas hayetzer, that's also the evil incarnation's plans. Hayetzer hara mamish al b'nei ha'adam, that's what the evil incarnation does to people. Ki ish milchamahu, he's a warrior, umuramid bar mimus, he's trained in trickery, cleverness. Vi efshar amalit mimanu arav chachma rabba v'ashkaf ha'gadol, it's very difficult to escape from the evil incarnation without a lot of wisdom and a lot of, you know, paying attention. Because that's his, you know, that's his scheme. He tries to make us constantly busy to the point where we can't think about what it is that we really want and what direction we want to go in life. So that's what Kobe says, is basically the distraction that prevents us from beginning with the end in mind. So until now, he's discussed beginning with the end in mind in the context of life as a whole, thinking about where we want to be, where we want to go in life in general, and avoiding distractions so that we can actually, not in the sense of avoiding distractions in a day-to-day sense, but in the sense of not being so bogged down with work that we'll never have time to think about, you know, answering that question of where we want to go in life. And then after that, for the rest of the chapter, Kobe discusses more specific projects that a person might want to involve themselves in, and beginning with the end in mind in those specific projects as well. So he says here on page 106, so begin with the end in mind is based on the principle that all things are created twice. And he explains what he means that they're created twice. Doesn't actually mean they're created twice. It means that, he says, there's a mental or first creation and a physical or second creation to all things. So first the person plans what they're going to create. That's what he's calling the first creation. And the second creation is when he actually does it. Take the construction of a home, for example. You create it in every detail before you ever hammer the first nail into place. So first, you know, you've pictured, you have the blueprints of exactly what you're going to build. Then only afterwards you go ahead and you actually build it. When I was trying to think of an example, you know, from Chazal that expressed a similar idea, it would have been nice if I found something relating to building a home. The only thing I could think of, you know, was a case of fighting a war, which is not quite as pleasant, but it's sort of the same idea. And in those days, I guess there was something that, was a little more frequent.
Just briefly, we say, Sof maaseh b'machshava tchila.
True, when God created the world, that's good.
Right.
That's good. Do I have a pen here? Can I add that in? Can I borrow a pen from someone? Thank you. Just going to add that in. That's another good source of the same idea.
Machshava
tchila. Right, when God created the world, he had in mind what it was going to be, you know, and then he created it. Good, thank you.
No problem.
If anyone else has, you know, good examples of this, please join in. We'll make the source sheets, you know, twice as long if we ever go through these sources again. We'll have twice as long source sheets. Compile together.
It's okay.
Fine. So when talking about fighting a war, so the Gemara says in Brachos that miyad yoatzim ba'achitofel, they would take advice from Achitofel. Achitofel actually was not such a good guy. He helped David HaMelech's son rebel against him. He was not a good guy, but he was very smart and he was quite a battle planner. So Rashi here, I'm just going to jump back and forth here between source 7 and source 8, because 8 is the Rashi on the Gemara in 7. So Rashi says, Yoatzim ba'achitofel, they would take advice from Achitofel, Eze ha-derech yelchu, which direction, which paths they should take, which roads they should take, v'heach yativu matzavu mashchus, how they should stand up the formations of the, you know, of their destructive forces, v'tachsise ma'arav melchama, and the tactics of ambush and war. So they would ask Achitofel to come up with the war plans. And then Nimwachin b'Sanhedrin, the Gemara says, they would ask the Sanhedrin. Rashi says they would ask the high rabbinic court for permission to go to battle. And the reason why they asked them was because if they got their permission, then the rabbinic court would daven, would pray on their behalf. V'shar and v'urim v'tumim. They would then ask the urim v'tumim, right, which is what the special article of clothing the Kohen Gadol would wear, which could also answer questions in a miraculous way. So they would do all that. Amar of Yosef Maikra, what's the pasuk that teaches us this? The pasuk says, V'acharei Achitofel, after Achitofel, was Benayahu ben Yehoyada, that's he was one of the leaders of the Sanhedrin, of the rabbinic court. We have Yasar, he was the Kohen. Vesar Tzavar, Melech Yoav. And then after that comes the general. In other words, the point is that before they got to the general, before they were going to carry out the battle plans, what they did before that was they planned it all out. They had their general come up with, or the planner, Achitofel, came up with all the tactics, and they made sure there were people to daven on their behalf, and that they asked the Kohen Gadol if they were going to be successful. And then once it was all planned out, you know, then they jumped into it. But they didn't jump into it without first planning it out. So I didn't put something on the source sheet, but Kovi made another important point. He said that the first habit that we discussed last week was being proactive. And now we're discussing beginning with the end in mind. So he put the two together, and he said that everything has these two creations. Everything is created twice. There's the plan, and then it's carried out. He says if we're not proactive about making the plan in the first place, so then it will be made for us. So that's why you have to put the two together. You have to be proactive to put together that first plan to set up, the actual construction of carrying it out.
Don't we say the makom she'en ish ishtadol yos ish? Where's that? The makom pekar avos b'makom she'en ish ishtadol yos ish.
Okay, so therefore you're saying a person should get up if there's no one else who's filling that
right.
role, so they should.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. For sure. Okay. So, fine. So the next thing that Kovi talks about is the difference between what he calls management and leadership. So he explains like this. Management is a bottom line focus. How can I best accomplish certain things? Meaning, how can I get it done? By the way, I had never heard the phrase top line before. I always heard bottom line as like the most important thing. Like the bottom line is, right? I never heard the phrase top line before. Here, Kovi is going to use top line as being almost like more important. So he says, management is a bottom line focus. How can I best accomplish certain things? Leadership deals with the top line. What are the things I want to accomplish? I mean, that comes first. First, I need to decide what I want to accomplish. And then the next question is, how can I best accomplish those things? In the words of both Peter Drucker and Warren Bennis, management is doing things right. Leadership is doing the right things. So first you have to have leadership, decide what the right things are. Then you have management to figure out how to do those things correctly. Management is efficiency in climbing the ladder of success. Once the ladder is in the right place, now you have to go up it properly. But leadership determines whether the ladder is leaning against the right wall. So well, leadership is first deciding which direction the person wants to go in, and then management is carrying it out effectively. This reminds me of, I put the source down here. I was a little disappointed when I looked this up inside, because I had always remembered this as a story that was taught to me in Camp Moshava after I finished fifth grade. I think there's Moshava here in Toronto also. I went to the Moshava in Pennsylvania, in New York, and not New York, near New York in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is not New York, sorry about that. We think everything is New York. Me and my fellow arrogant New Yorkers. Pennsylvania is not New York, it's near New York. So I remember, I think it was the summer after fifth grade. So basically every day we had like a 40-minute shiur. We called it shiur for some reason, that's what we called it. I don't know why. But I remember the teacher telling us a story, which I thought was very powerful, and I didn't know what the source was. And later I came across the source. But I had forgotten the details of the source. I forgot that it was a little different than the story that was originally told to me. And I think it was nicer than the way it was told to me the first time. But basically the story goes that you have someone who travels to a faraway land. And in that faraway land, they have like precious jewels, precious stones like all over the floor, right? And it's like all over the streets. Like you could pick it up, you could become like a multi-billionaire or whatever. But the thing is that in that country, because it's so common, it's not worth anything. So what's important, what's valuable in that country is banana peels. That was how it was taught to me in fifth grade. It was banana peels. So the thing was that people who lived there, they dealt in banana peels. So this foreigner who had come from a regular place where the precious stones are a lot more valuable, at the beginning he's taking all the precious stones and storing them up, putting them in his pocket, saving them. He's going to go back and become very wealthy. Over the course of time, he starts getting distracted. All of a sudden, he's into the banana peels. Because that's what people do business in this place. In the story, the guy puts in a tremendous effort to accumulate all these banana peels. And he's really doing a very good job. His management, carrying out what he's trying to do, he's doing a very good job at that. The problem is his leadership of himself, that his ladder is up against the wrong wall. So that's how the story was told to me with the banana peels. That story is from the Chafetz Chaim here in Sefer Torah Sabayis, which is here in Source 9. He left out the banana peels. Oh well. But what he says is, he's trying to explain why Hashem sent us down into this world. And he says that it's comparable to a king who sends his son to a faraway land. And I'll just pick up from reading from the beginning here. Sham hakor hachazak, it's very cold there. Umach mazem mukhrok is rabbe sham bimabushim agasim v'ovim ma'od. He has to wear these very heavy clothing. The gam was chaber bechevras anashim pshutim sheinam bnei mino. He's friendly with people who are, I guess, a little different than the friends of a prince. The gam rozen mizonos gasim ma'od. He has to have food, which is not like he was served in the palace, whatever, etc. And the point is, because just skipping a little bit for the sake of time, because they have these precious stones, which are so bright that they shine from so far away. But the problem is that in this place, they're so accustomed to these things that they don't pay so much attention to them. People can get distracted. But the point is that a person should make every effort to gather up all of these precious stones so that when they return home, they have the wealth, in their pocket. So I think this just expresses that idea that before management comes leadership. Before we can discuss and we can try to be very effective in what we're doing, we first have to make sure that we're doing what we want to be doing. So that's basically the idea here, although he doesn't express the distraction of the banana peels, whatever. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting so emotional about the banana peels. But anyway. So then Covey discusses what can we do practically to be effective in this area of leadership, in beginning with the end in mind. So he writes here on page 113, "The most effective way I know to begin with the end in mind is to develop a personal mission statement or philosophy or creed. It focuses on what you want to be, that's in terms of character, what you want to be, who you want to be, that's a person's own character, and to do, what a person wants to do, their contributions and achievements, and on the values or principles upon which being and doing are based." So what are those values that the person holds that's going to, you know, direct what they're going to want to be in terms of character and what they're going to want to do in terms of achievements. So this idea about having a mission statement, I wasn't sure whether to put on, I was looking for a good source for a mission statement. So I put on this Rabbeinu Yonah here in source 10. It doesn't line up exactly. Basically what he's talking about here is the Mishnah says that Kol Shema'asav Merubin Mechachmaso, Chachmaso Miskayemes, that anyone whose actions exceed their wisdom, so their wisdom will stand strong, will remain.
What does that mean, the actions will exceed their wisdom?
I think you're probably troubled by Rabbeinu Yonah's question, and he asks, how can a person's actions exceed their wisdom if I don't know what to do? If I don't have the wisdom to know what to do, I can't do it. So it almost sounds like Rabbeinu Yonah understood the Mishnah to mean that what it means for one's actions to exceed their wisdom is that they keep more mitzvot than they know about. But that makes no sense. How can I fulfill more mitzvot than I know about it? If I don't know about it, how can I fulfill it? So that's Rabbeinu Yonah's question. So his answer is that when a person decides for themselves, I'm going to do whatever I learn to be the right thing, then it's as if they fulfilled all those mitzvot. If I tell myself, whenever I learn that something is the right thing to do, I'm going to do it, even though I don't know about that particular thing yet, it's counted right now, Hashem counts it right now, as if I fulfilled all those mitzvot throughout the rest of my life. And Rabbeinu Yonah actually advises that this is a good thing for a person to think about before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you know, when we're trying to get extra merits. So how do we get a lot of extra merits in a very short amount of time? We just decide, from now on, I'm going to do whatever's right. And then, in whatever situation, the person's accepting on themselves to do whatever's right, it's as if they already did it to some degree. So this connects in some way to a mission statement. I think it is a little bit of a stretch. But the point is that the person has a mission statement that I'm always going to do whatever is correct, whatever is proper, whatever principles I value. If that's a person's mission statement, to always do what's right in the moment, so then a person can make decisions throughout the course of their life based on the principles that they value, and how they, you know, come together in that particular decision that the person is trying to address. So I guess it's a form of mission statement. It's a mission statement that I'm going to do what I believe to be right in any given situation. I think there's a better example of a mission statement when it comes to the next point that Covey makes. So we'll see that. We'll see that now. He talks about having a mission statement for each of our roles in life.
Right.
So he says, we each have a number of different roles in our lives. One of the major problems that arises when people work to become more effective in life is that they don't think broadly enough. They lose the sense of proportion, the balance, the natural ecology necessary to effective living. They may get consumed by work and neglect personal health. In the name of professional success, they may neglect the most precious relationships in their lives. You may find that your mission statement will be much more balanced, much easier to work with, if you break it down into the specific role areas of your life and the goals you want to accomplish in each area. So take, for example, he said that a person might get consumed by work and neglect personal health. So then if a person has two roles, they have a role at work and they have a role with regard to their own personal health, so then they'll create mission statements for each one of those roles to make sure that one of those roles doesn't overshadow the other one and prevent them from thinking about the other one as well. So there are two Gemaras that I thought give us a glimpse into the mission statement with regard to a particular role of one of the greatest Tanoim, Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana. I think he was one of Rabbi Akiva's either Rebbeim or friends. I'm not sure. And I think also one of the Kabbalah Sfarim, I've never learned Kabbalah Sfarim, but I think like one of the famous Kabbalah Sfarim, I forgot what its name was written by him. Right, the Zohar we know in general, we assume was written by Rav Shimon bar Yochai, even though I've heard there's a controversy surrounding that, but we generally assume the Zohar was written by Rav Shimon bar Yochai. But I think there's a different Sefer that's written by Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana. So this is one of the greatest Tanoim. So there are two Gemaras which give us a glimpse into how he viewed his role as a friend. So the Gemara says, Shahu Talmidav Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana. So his students asked him, Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana's students asked him, Bameh Erach Dayamim, how did you merit to live such a long life? Like, what great things did you do to merit to live such a long life? Amalohem, he responded to them, Miyamai lonis kabarati bekon chaveirai. I never took honor from the disgrace of my friends. Now, not only did I never put them down, but I never sort of saw them in a degrading situation, and saw myself in a more elevated situation, and like enjoyed the fact and took honor in the fact that, you know, I was doing better than them. I never did that. I never went to sleep, went to bed with, and the Gemara is going to explain what this means in a minute, but I never went to bed with the mindset of cursing my friends. Uvasron b'mamoni hayisi, and I was always very forgiving, if that's the right word. I always was willing to give in when it came to monetary matters. If there was ever a monetary dispute, I would always just, give in. So lo niskabarati b'kon chavei, right? The Gemara now explains each one of these. So what does it mean to not take honor in the degradation of one's friend? Ki hadu Rav Huna darimara akasvei. So an example of that could be Rav Huna was carrying some type of shovel on his shoulder. Also Rav Chana bar Chaniroi v'kadari minei. So a different rabbi, Rav Chana bar Chaniroi, came by and, you know, took the shovel from him so he wouldn't have to carry it. He was like respecting him, showing him honor by saying, I'll carry the shovel instead of you. So Amarei, so the first one, Rav Huna, said back, Iregilas de daris v'masach, if you normally carry a shovel in your own city, dari, then thank you for the favor. That's great. V'iro, and if you wouldn't do this, you know, in your own town, is yakure yanab is yirusa didach onichli. I don't want to take honor, you know, from your degradation. If this is, you know, beneath your dignity to carry a shovel around in your town, so then, I don't want you to do this just to do me the favor of taking it from me. And then the Gemara gives an example of the next thing here. V'lo also amitasi kilel aschaveirai. I never went to bed with the mindset of cursing my friend. Ki hadem arzutra, ki avasalik lapurye. When Marzutra would go to bed, Amar, he said, shari leilichol man detzaron. I forgive anyone who caused me pain. This, by the way, is included in the text of Kriya Shema Sharamita. Right, that we say that he wrote some, that Hashem should forgive anyone who did something negative, you know, to me. Uvastun b'mamoni hayisi. I was always willing to give in when it came to monetary matters. D'amar mar iyo vastun b'mamoni hava. Iyo was someone who would give in when it came to money. Shahaya meiniach pruta lechanvani mimamoni. It's a little different than I explained before. It's not even that there was a dispute, but he would basically say keep the change. So he wasn't so insistent on keeping everything that he was entitled to. So this is how Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana says that he merited to live such a long life. And these are all things which relate to interpersonal interactions. That he never took honor from the degradation of his friends. He never went to bed without forgiving his friends. He never was insistent on this is mine. I don't want to give it up. And there's another Gemara which expresses a similar idea. The Mishnah says in Brachos, Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana haya mispara b'knisaso lebeis hamedrash v'yitziaso tefila katara. When Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana would begin the day learning, so he would daven a certain tefila, and at the end of the day, he would also daven another short tefillah. Amru lo, so they said to him, Mam makom wa tefillah zo, like, what's the place of this tefillah? Like, what are you praying for? Amru lohem, he said, B'knisasi ani misparel shol yered devar takor al yodi, when I go into the base medrash, so I daven that I shouldn't make a mistake. U'bitziasi ani nosin hoda al chalki, and when I leave, I thank Hashem for giving me the opportunity to learn. So the Gemara says, what exactly did he say? Tanu Rabbanan b'knisaso mahu omer. What did he say when he went into the base medrash? So he said, "Yehi rotzon milfanecha Hashem Elokai, it should be your will, Hashem my God, shelo yera dvar takor al yodi, that I shouldn't make a mistake. V'roa kasha b'dvar halacha, I shouldn't make a mistake when it comes to halacha. V'yismechu b'chaveirai. Now there are two ways to interpret, and that's why in the English here, when I translated this, but these are my translations, so there's a grammatical problem, I take the full blame. So there are two different opinions how to translate this phrase. He says, I shouldn't stumble in halacha. V'yismechu b'chaveirai. One option is, I shouldn't stumble in halacha to the point where my friends laugh at my downfall, that I made a mistake. The other way of reading it is, v'lo akash, I shouldn't make a mistake. V'yismechu b'chaveirai, and my friends should rejoice in the fact that I did such a good job. And then he says the same thing, the flip side, v'lo omer al tamei tahor, if something is impure, I shouldn't say it's pure. V'lo al tahor tamei, if something is pure, I shouldn't say it's impure. And then, v'lo yikashu chaveirai b'dvar halacha, my friends shouldn't make a mistake when they say what the halacha is. V'esmach bohem, also the same two ways of reading it. But the nicer way of reading it, both of them drive at the same point. Both of them drive at the fact that I should be very happy when my friends are successful, and I should not be happy, I should not be happy when my friends are unsuccessful. So, from both of these Gemaras, we see that Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana presumably had a certain mission statement about how to about his role as a friend and his role in interactions with other people. He was someone who never wanted to take honor from their friend being put down. He never wanted something bad to happen to someone else, you know, as a result of him. He was very forgiving of them before he went to sleep. You know, he was that type of person. So it sort of sets an example for the idea that a person should have a mission statement with regard to each role, that they have in life. And I think an additional point on that is that this Gemara in Megillah, where they in source 11, where the students asked Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, "How did you merit such a long life?" That's part of a chain in the Gemara there of like 10 different Amoraim or Tanoim who all lived very long lives. And the Gemara says that each one of their students asked them, "How did you merit a long life? How did you merit a long life?" And they each give a different answer. And what seems to be from there is that they each had their own mission statement. There was a particular area where each one of them really, you know, invested their focus. And that's why they were so successful in that area. And they merited very long life because of the fact that they excelled in that specific area, which I think leads to the conclusion that if a person creates a mission statement for one particular role in life, again, Covey is suggesting that we create mission statements for all of our roles in life, and I think that that's the best way to do it. But even just a mission statement for one role in life can have repercussions for everything else, to the point where, you know, in a, you know, miraculous way, they can merit to have long life, or perhaps even in a natural way, they can merit to have long life. But there's a lot of value to a mission statement for each independent a role that a person has in life. Mine isn't stapled, so I get lost as to where I'm going here. Fine. So the next thing Kobe discusses is, I forgot my watch, so I'm just going to look at my phone to make sure I got the time. 44. Okay, perfect. So the next thing that Kobe discusses is being principle-centered. Oh, thank you. there's a clock there. Awesome. Okay, thank you. So then just so you don't forget to take your watch. Okay, or so I don't forget to return your watch.
Also, you can go a little bit after 9.
What?
Go a little bit after 9.
Okay, I'll try, and if I say that I'm finishing at 9, I'm going to try and finish at 9, and whatever. Fine, no, but I think I listened to the feedback that I got last time to try and have only one source on each point that Covey makes for two reasons. First of all, because it's hard to think of sources for all of these, so it's a challenge as it is to try and find one, but also because I think that then it feels less rushed and we can get through more of them, and it's just more misudar, I think, so... I followed the feedback I was given, which means that if anyone else has more feedback, you can rest assured that I'll probably follow it. It's worth giving. Fine. So the next point that Covey makes is being principle-centered. So he writes like this. By centering our lives on correct principles, we create a solid foundation for development of the four life support factors. And now he's going to explain what these four life support factors are. Our security comes from knowing that unlike other centers based on people or things which are subject to frequent and immediate change, correct principles do not change. We can depend on them. In other words, there's security in knowing that the decisions that we're making are being made from something which is solid, which is not going to be, you know, going back and forth. It's on the principles of something which will remain the same. The wisdom and guidance that accompany principle-centered living come from correct maps, from the way things really are, have been, and will be. Those principles are true. I mean, if we get the correct principles, and, you know, then we know that we're working with, you know, a description of reality. Correct maps enable us to clearly see where we want to go and how to get there. We can make our decisions using the correct data that will make their implementation possible and meaningful. And then the fourth of his life support factors is power. The personal power that comes from principle-centered living is the power of a self-aware, knowledgeable, proactive individual, unrestricted by the attitudes, behaviors, and actions of others, or by many of the circumstances and environmental influences that limit other people. So I put here, he has a list of other possible centers that a person may make their decisions based on. Family, money, work, possessions, pleasure, friend, enemy, religious institution, spouse, or self. He basically describes an example there. His Kobe's example is basically that a person had decided that they were going to go to some type of a recreational event with family, and then their boss calls them and tells them that they want to work late. They want them to work late that night, you know, to produce some type of project. So a person who's, you know, running, who's family centered is going to make a decision based on the priorities of family. A person who's money centered or work centered or possession centered will make a decision, you know, based on that. And what Covey argues is that the ideal is to be principle-centered. Because when a person's principle-centered, they take into account all the things that they truly value, and they use that as guidance for what decision to make in that particular situation. So,
yeah. There's four life support factors. So which are the four?
One is security, and then he sort of lumps together wisdom and guidance. I'm not sure what exactly that he intends the difference to be between those two. So security, if I understand it correctly, is basically the knowledge that the center that I'm using to make my decisions is something which is not going to change. It's going to be a standard which will remain the same. And then the wisdom and guidance of being principle-centered is that being principle-centered is a correct description of, to use his example, the map, meaning the map is an accurate description of the territory only if the map is accurate. So being principle-centered gives a person correct maps. Mm-hmm. In other words, because reality is based on principles. And then the fourth is this personal power, that a person makes a decision based on what, I guess it connects to being proactive. They make a decision based on what they really believe to be correct, and they're not, driven one way and the other by the things that he lists here, the circumstances, you know, other people, other people's attitudes, you know, etc., that they are able to feel the power to make the decision based on what they believe is right. Yeah. So, fine. So, there's a poem in the Michtav Meir Eliyahu, which is written by Rav Dessler. This sounds familiar. This poem may be somewhere else also. I don't know. It just sounded familiar. But I didn't have it on my Bar Ilan, so that's why it's a picture taken on my phone. But he says here, Ha'ovar ach zichronos. The past is only memories. Ve'ha'osid letikvas dimyonos. And the future is just imaginary hopes. Ach ha'hove, but the present, re'ebo lihiponos. Look and focus and pay attention. Direct your attention to the present. Chayechahu, because that's your life. V'kulo rak nisyonos, and the present is only tests. And the reason why I think that connects the idea of being principle-centered is to be principle-centered means that whenever I'm faced with a decision, I'm going to try to decide based on, you know, the principles that I value. And it's not going to be based on a concern, what's going to be in the future if I do this, or something like this happened in the past and that has to affect and, you know, determine what I'm going to do now. It's that the past and the future are removed from the equation. The truth is, I shouldn't say it like that, because sometimes principles are connected and, you know, intertwined with the future, because a person has to take the future into account when they're planning something. But they do so through the, I guess you would say, through the prism of I lost my train of thought. They do so through the prism of, you know, what they value, what's important to them, what their principles are. So while it's true a person has to take into account the future, it's not that they're driven by some imaginary, you know, dream of, you know, how things should be, could be. It's based on how their principles tell them to act now, based on a logical assessment of the future. Fine. And the last piece in this chapter in Kovi is the value of visualization. So he writes here on page 141, I can spend a few minutes each day and totally relax my mind and body. I can think about situations in which my children might misbehave. I can visualize them in rich detail. I can feel the texture of the chair I might be sitting on, the floor under my feet, the sweater I'm wearing. I can see the dress my daughter has on, the expression on her face. The more clearly and vividly I can imagine the detail, the more deeply I will experience it. The less I will see it as a spectator, meaning I'll really feel like, you know, it's me in that situation. Then I can see or do something very specific which normally makes my heart pound and my temper start to flare. But instead of seeing my normal response, which I guess is an inappropriate response of anger perhaps, I can see myself handle the situation with all the love, the power, the self-control I have captured in my affirmation. I can write the program, write the script in harmony with my values, with my personal mission statement. So once a person has a personal mission statement for a particular role, they can then visualize themselves making the right decisions in the moment to carry out, you know, the values of that mission statement. And if I do this day after day, my behavior will change. Instead of living out the scripts given to me by my own parents or by society or by genetics or my environment, I'll be living out the script I have written from my own self-selected value system. So the power of visualization. So we find this idea also in Michtav Meir Eliyahu. There's also a picture taken on my phone. So this is a little bit different. Again, it's challenging finding you know, Torah sources to match each one of these points of Kovi. So this is also a little bit of a jump, but it's along similar lines. So Rav Deskler writes that starting here from Tziurim, it's towards the end of the first line here in the picture, Tziurei Harev, that the Tziurim means visualizing, images in one's heart. Hainu laharbus pekoach hadimyon, to increase the strength of one's imagination. Tziurim muchashiyim, that images which really are like almost tangible, binyanei kedusha, with regards to aspects of holiness. Shenargish kmo chayas haosher hanifra shabas, so that we can properly, so we can feel the wondrous pleasure of these holy things sort of come to life. How did the Avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, how did they attain great levels? How did all the great people in the course of history attain their great levels? Why were they stronger than us? How were they able to do this? The Heshiv, and he answered, Heim Yoduas Akoach Adir Shebitziurei Halev. They recognized the tremendous power of creating images in a person's heart. Our evil inclination knows this trick. The evil inclination's entire battle plan is to create these images for us and these imaginations that he uses to trap our heart and to trap us in his net. The only way to fight him is with his own weaponry, by increasing to visualize, you know, things of holiness. The tzaddikim always imagined the pleasures of Gan Eden, the hatainug hanifra shebederech Hashem, and the great pleasures in following the way of God. That's the way they were able to conquer, you know, all their tests, all their challenges. So it's a little bit different than the idea that Kovi is suggesting, because Kovi is suggesting imagining a specific circumstance where one might be tempted to respond in the wrong way. Someone may get on my nerves and I may respond to them angrily, so I imagine myself in full detail in that situation responding to them calmly. That's a little different than Rav Dessler here, who's talking about, in general, imagining the wonderful nature of a life of godliness. But either way, we see the value of visualization. When one visualizes the pleasures of a life of serving God, so that leads a person to be interested in pursuing those pleasures of a life of serving God. And just the power of visualization is certainly something that we find here, even though it's in slightly different ways. So just to summarize, this chapter is about beginning with the end in mind. So Kovi discusses both beginning with the end in mind in terms of the totality of a person's life, and this example that he began with of imagining, you know, what it would be like, you know, when a person, you know, passes away, and, you know, what goals they want to attain. And then he also speaks about beginning with the end in mind in each particular, you know, endeavor that a person, you know, chooses to get involved in. He speaks about avoiding the distractions of getting caught up and being so busy that one's never able to think about what it is that they really want in life. He differentiates between management and leadership, and that management is being efficient at carrying out what you want to carry out, but leadership is deciding what it is that you want to carry out, and leadership is that necessary step before management. And then he speaks about the way to effective leadership, to deciding what it is that we want, is to create a personal mission statement for each role in our lives. And then he speaks about the importance of being principle-centered, of making decisions based on the principles that one knows to be true. And then he speaks about how one of the ways that we can implement this is by taking our mission statement and then understanding how that would translate in, you know, our day-to-day life, and then visualizing, you know, how that translates into our day-to-day life so that we can carry out, you know, what we intend to.